Today is Wednesday, July 19th. We're going to wrap up fluid electrolyte balance today. I'm going to work you through pages 122 and 123. Okay, so back in the blood vessels chapter, we talked about fluid exchange at capillaries. I want to review the normal setup for fluid exchange first, and then we're going to dive into what happens if you change the pressures. You must have got your grade. Good. Either that or you're really excited about fluid capillary exchange, which I figure was not the case. Okay, so you guys are probably familiar with this, the hydrostatic and osmotic pressure push-pull battle. The hydrostatic pressure is based on what? Water or salts and proteins?
Water.
Okay, so I'm just going to make a little note here that BHP is based on the water in our blood plasma, and the BOP is created by what?
Solutes.
Yes, or proteins. So things like albumin, for instance, contribute to blood osmotic pressure. The fluid in your blood plasma contributes instead to your blood hydrostatic pressure. So which one of these pressures, BHP or BOP, is the pushy pressure?
BHP,
good. So it's the pressure that pushes. And of course, BOP is going to create a pull toward the higher salt or solute concentration. Okay, so when we're thinking about the battle of the pressures at the arterial end of your capillary, the higher pressure wins, we push out fluids into the interstitial space. I didn't make a big deal about it back in the earlier chapter, but I want to make a note here that the first area that can be accessed is going to be that interstitial space. So we accumulate fluid in the interstitial space, we call that interstitial fluid, and then that fluid can then be pulled into the cells. So the cells may eventually use that fluid as well. At the venule end of your capillary, due to the outflow of fluids, we see a drop in our BHP or hydrostatic pressure. So we no longer have the ability to push fluids out. Instead, we're pulling them back in for reabsorption. So thinking about the area outside your capillary, when we're reabsorbing fluids, what is the first area that we can access?
Interstitial
fluid is first, and then you can actually go after your intracellular second. Okay, so it's easiest to pull from your interstitial space first, and then after that area becomes hypertonic, you can then pull from your cell space next. Same concept going out in the other direction. You push fluids into the IF first, and then you push it into your cells next. We know that only around 90% of our fluids are picked up by the venule end of your capillary. What happens to the remaining 10% that's in the interstitial space? Lymphatic system, good. So we'll just put a lymphatic vessel out here. It is going to pick up those excess fluids. And if your lymphatic system is not efficient at its job, what happens?
Swelling,
good. We call that edema, and edema technically involves extra fluid in which particular space?
Interstitial,
right. So if you have too many fluids in the interstitial space, we call that edema, and we can point the finger at not having an effective lymphatic system or not reabsorbing adequate fluids. Okay, so to take the next step, I gotta make sure you're comfortable here. Do you have any questions about this push and pull relationship? So if you feel pretty good with this, let's now take this into a problem scenario, which is going to be our fluid electrolyte balance problem. And that'll help us explore dehydration and overhydration. I'm going to move so you can get a good picture. You're good. It's like I'm like panicking and yelling here. Okay, so why don't we talk about dehydration versus overhydration? When you hear the word dehydration, I know that most of our minds think about water loss, but it's more than that. Dehydration here can also be salt, solute, or protein loss. So the word loss is what we're thinking of here, and when we're thinking about dehydration, you want to think about what are you primarily losing? Okay. It could be water if it's hydrostatic pressure, or what else could it be?
Salt.
Salt, protein, and that could be osmotic pressure, yeah. So the laws can come in two forms there. When we think about the term overhydration, we're actually thinking of not loss, but rather a gain. So the case that we're going to focus on is actually water gain. We're not going to really focus too much on salt or solute gain, not in this scenario at least. Okay. So let's take the easy form of dehydration first. Let's talk about a one-off case of diarrhea, which causes an equal loss of salt, solutes, proteins, and water. So the clue word here is equal loss. Okay? And the equal loss is the clue word that drives us in the direction of an isotonic dehydration event. All right, so what happens to BHP if you lose water? Goes down, decreases. And if you lose salt, solutes, and proteins, your BOP also decreases. So here's the problem. If you lose equal amounts of water, salt, solutes, and proteins, then you don't really make a great shift in your ability to filter or reabsorb. And so we see no net movement of water into your capillary versus out of your capillary. Basically, everything continues as normal. Dehydration is the easy one, you might say, because it's an equal loss, and we don't have to decide if cells bloat or shrivel because they're not going to do either. They're going to stay at, you know, pretty much an equilibrium with their surrounding environment. Okay, so let's then take a more problematic scenario and go with hypotonic dehydration. In this case, what are we losing from the bloodstream?
Salt,
solutes, proteins, any one of those will work. Okay, so hypotonic dehydration involves some loss of salt, solutes, proteins from the bloodstream. And since those are tied to BOP, we're going to say that we're losing BOP from the bloodstream. So thinking about our normal push and pull scenario, if you decrease your BOP from 26, let's be dramatic and knock it down to 10. What does that affect your ability to do?
Reabsorb,
yes. So you're no longer able to pull the fluids back into the capillary. So where are they collecting and gathering first?
Interstitial fluid.
Interstitial fluid, good. And if those fluids are in fact hypotonic, then what happens to your cells? They bloat. Right. Hypo. Yep. So back in 2:10, when you guys learned about hypotonic solutions, you probably learned they bloat your cells. So that's the catch, is a hypotonic dehydration event still bloats your cells. Now we just know the underlying mechanism for it. So let's follow the water pathway. And we're going to say that it goes from the capillary to the interstitial fluid. And from from the interstitial fluid, it can force its way into your cells. And cells will bloat. Okay, so now you just took your last lab exam this morning. Yay.
Yay.
Okay. So I know you learned about some problematic scenarios with stuff in your urine that should not be there. Can you give me an example of something that should be in your urine that indicates a problem?
Blood.
Okay, that's one. How about another?
Proteins.
Okay, I'm going to pick on that one. That's a good one. What did you call it when you had proteins in the urine?
Albuminuria.
Good. Albuminuria. Good. So albumin, you might recall, is one of those important plasma proteins. And if you're losing it from your bloodstream into your urine, then you have albuminuria. Okay. So that is what we're going to look at here. Let's set ourselves up with that as a problem. We've got albuminuria. We're losing proteins from the bloodstream. That loss of proteins will cause fluids to escape at the arterial end thanks to high hydrostatic pressure. But why can't you reabsorb at the venule end? Pressure's too low. Good. Which pressure is going to help you reabsorb normally?
BOP.
Good. So now we can take this a step further and say, okay, if you've got albuminuria, then you're going to have hypotonic dehydration, and you're going to lose fluids to the interstitial space. So if you put fluids in the interstitial space, what happens to that area? It swells, edema. Yes, so cells bloat, and the interstitial space, that is called IF, we expect to see edema there. Okay, so we expect to see edema in that interstitial space. Okay, thinking back, this is a great time for review of that old stuff. Can you tell me the name of a hormone that helps to retain sodium? Aldosterone, good. So what if you don't have enough aldosterone? What happens to your sodium that's traveling through your kidneys? It goes out, right? So you lose it in your urine. So you've got really salty urine and not enough sodium in your bloodstream. So that is another case where you can end up losing extra salt, there we go, with another case of hypotonic dehydration. We call it hypoaldosteronism, or we have another name for it. Is it Addison's disease or Cushing's syndrome? Addison's, yeah. So now we've come full circle back to that endocrine stuff one more time. So Addison's disease can also give you a case of cells bloating, interstitial space of edema, and that's all due to the loss of salt from your bloodstream and losing it into the urine. Okay. Does this make pretty good sense, what happens with hypotonic dehydration? Okay. Let's do the other side. Let's do hypertonic dehydration. Keep in mind, we're looking at dehydration from a perspective of loss. So this time, what are we losing from your blood?
Water.
Losing water. Good. We know that there's two pressures in the capillary, blood hydrostatic pressure and blood osmotic pressure. So loss of water leads to a decrease in our blood hydrostatic pressure. Is that the pushing pressure or the pulling pressure?
The push.
The push, right. So we're losing the ability to push out those fluids. All right, so thinking about our normal scenario down there, does that primarily influence our ability to filter or to reabsorb?
Filter,
okay. So let's take our BHP and knock it down to about 10 across the length of your capillary. What are we doing now with the fluids? Can't push it out, and you're pulling it back in. From what space first?
Interstitial.
Interstitial.
Got it, good. So interstitial fluid. Okay. So you have the water coming from the interstitial fluid into the capillary first, because that's easiest to access. And when you dry out your interstitial space, now you start pulling fluids out of your intracellular fluid compartment inside your cell. You pull it into the interstitial space and then eventually back into the capillary. What happens to cells in this situation?
Shrivel.
Yep, shrivel, shrink. Crenate, all these are good terms. Okay, let's think of some scenarios here. Back when we covered endocrine, we talked about a couple of hormones that help you retain water. Which hormone has nothing to do with sodium retention and only promotes water retention?
ADH.
ADH, good. So ADH prevents dehydration and promotes hydration. And if you happen to have low levels of ADH, what disorder do we diagnose?
Diabetes insipidus.
Good. So in the case of diabetes insipidus, we're losing large amounts of dilute urine and we're pulling the water out of the blood plasma. So how does this link to being a case of hypertonic dehydration? Excessive urine output, good. Which pressure do we lose?
Hydrostatic,
good. And so what does that do at our capillaries?
Oh, it'll make you have low blood pressure.
It'll make you have low blood pressure, exactly. Which particular pressure is being influenced? Yeah, BHP, good, which is the same thing as blood pressure, so you're exactly right, good. And of course, this pulls fluids from the interstitial space first. It's the easiest compartment to access, and then you pull from your cells second. And of course, those cells will shrivel. Let's think of another scenario with this. Let me give you one that could be any of these three, and see if you can help me figure out where we're going to put this one. Let's say that we have someone who's had chronic diarrhea, and chronic diarrhea leads to the primary loss of solutes and proteins from the bloodstream. All right, so what type of dehydration would chronic diarrhea lead to?
Hypotonic.
Yeah, hypotonic. Good. So how do you know? Loss of solutes and proteins. Good. So will this person have cell spaces that are bloated or shriveled up?
Bloated.
Does that make any sense with diarrhea?
No.
That's crazy, isn't it? You think about diarrhea and you think about this person who's being dried out, but in fact, it's not the water that's the primary issue, it is the salt protein. Yeah. So when we think about things that cause us to lose water, we got to think big picture here. How much water do you have, say, in your bloodstream? How much water you got in your bloodstream? And how much of those 5 liters are blood cells? 45%, yeah. So of those 5 liters, you're looking at about 2.5 liters being fluid. So that's not the majority of our fluid. Where's the majority of our fluid stored?
Inside
cells, yes. Yeah. So we're thinking about the balance between salt, solutes, proteins, and water. We have to keep the perspective here that the majority of our fluids are not in the blood. The majority are, in fact, inside our cells. All right, let me give you one more scenario, and then we'll work through some practice problems. The last scenario is not a loss situation. It's rather a gain situation. And in this scenario, we're looking at an overhydration that's called hypotonic hydration. Another name for hypotonic hydration is water intoxication.
All right, so we're looking at a gain of water to the bloodstream with hypotonic hydration or water intoxication. And we know that water contributes to which pressure? Hydrostatic. So since this is a gain perspective, we're going to increase blood hydrostatic pressure. Let's be dramatic and say that down there for our normal scenario, instead of 35 dropping to the mid-teens, let's be bold and say we've got 75 millimeters mercury pushing out at the arterial end, and we drop to 50 at the venule end. So how does that influence this push-pull mechanism? Push more, yeah. So we're pushing fluids out, we're unable to do what?
Reabsorb,
good. So we do push fluids into the interstitial space first. Excess fluids in the interstitial space cause what?
Edema,
yeah. And then eventually those cells will bloat, and so we see bloated cells as well. So we see fluids flow from the capillary to the interstitial space first, causing edema, and into the cells, causing them to bloat. So you probably heard this story before, but I'll mention it. It was in the news a few years ago. There was a contest in California called Hold Your Wii for Nintendo Wii. The radio station had people come in and drink gallons of water, and they said the last two Wii, or P, of course, is going to be the one who wins the Nintendo. Mm-hmm. And, of course, mom of three, 28 years old, went home with a horrible headache, laid down on her sofa, and called her own mother and said, "I've got an awful headache. I'm just going to lay here for a while."
Oh,
she died.
Yeah, yes. She drowned.
Yes, she drowned, exactly. So, unfortunately, she was in water intoxication, and what had happened was she drank so much water over a short period of time that she couldn't absorb the fluids or her body couldn't process them. Thinking back, you know, just kind of as a side thought here, do you remember what the glomerular filtration rate is supposed to be? 120.
Yeah.
Okay. So we can filter by our kidneys about 120 milliliters of fluid per minute. If you think about your traditional Coke can, that's about half of a Coke can that can be filtered per minute. If you drink a gallon of fluid over, say, 10, 20 minutes of time, your kidneys say, "I don't work it at one speed. This is my speed. I don't go any faster." So your body just has to deal with this excess fluid. And it causes cerebral edema as well as edema all over your body. The problem is the cerebral edema because for this woman, it pushed her brain through her foramen magnum and crushed her brain stem.
Wow.
Yeah, so no wonder she had a horrible headache. Her brain was like a sponge and picking up all the excess fluids. Had she been taken to the hospital, what could they have done for her? Lasix. If you're going to give her an IV, what would you give her? Hyper or hypotonic IV fluids? Why hyper? Shrivel those cells. Yeah, pull that fluid out. So salt her up, get those fluids to travel out of those cells. Exactly. So that's why they say if you're going to rehydrate, to do it over a time period, not to just gulp an entire gallon of fluid at one time. Because our bodies can't process it, because our kidneys have a certain speed they work at. People who work outside and sweat profusely are losing a lot of salt, but they're also losing a lot of water. And if they rehydrate with just tap water that has no electrolytes in there, then they're creating a case of hypotonic hydration. So you may know someone who works construction or outside that carries salt packets, and of course that tastes nasty, but it keeps the fluid electrolyte balance going properly. So let's say you do have a construction worker who works in a hot environment. If that person drinks only fluids and doesn't balance the electrolytes, what are we doing to the pressure balance? Just fluids, they don't take in any electrolytes. They're increasing filtration. Good, good. And so how would we classify this? Yeah, you could say it's hypotonic hydration. And if your perspective is one of gain, that would be a perfectly good choice. If your perspective is one of loss, because they sweated and they lost salt, hypotonic, dehydration, yeah. So that's how this can get tricky really fast, is it depends on your perspective. If it's one of gain, it's hydration. If it's one of loss, it's dehydration. But I'll tell you something that's really cool here. You'll notice the same thing results from hypotonic dehydration that results from hypotonic hydration. So losing BOP causes the same problems in your body that gaining BHP will cause. So that makes it a whole lot easier. Hypotonic dehydration and hypotonic hydration make you bloat. So that kind of eliminates one less thing for us to have to keep straight. Okay, how about questions so far? All right. There were some problems on pages 124 and 125. Let me take you to page 124, and we'll work through a couple of those together. All right, that first problem is done for us, so let's take that second problem. Seawater. Yeah, let's do that seawater one. Okay, to help you guys out, what I do in these problems is give you some kind of clue at the last part of the sentence, and you'll notice that seawater causes hypernatremia, and here we go, loss of fluids. That's what I need to know. It causes loss of fluids. That's my primary issue. All right, so is this hypertonic or hypotonic dehydration?
Hypotonic,
good. Okay. You sure?
Hypertonic,
yeah.
What? Oh.
Loss of fluids lead to hypotonic. Had this said a loss of salt, soluble protein, yeah, hypo would have been your best bet.
We try
to
trick this.
Yeah. It's backwards.
It's not there on a test. We're brain dead.
It's backwards, yeah, from what we, yeah. You know. Brain's been drained from the.
This is a lot of salt. I mean, if you drink salt water, you're pumping yourself full of salt.
Correct. And then balances, there's too much salt and not enough water. Okay, so I know this feels a little wobbly right now. If you're drinking fluids, I know you're thinking about, oh, I'm hydrating if I'm drinking fluids. And yeah, you may be putting some water into your body, but it's not enough water compared to the amount of salt that you're drinking in. That is the problem, because we're getting an imbalance between the ratio of salt and water. So in fact, you're putting more salt in your body and the ratio is not enough water. That loss of fluids is what we want to pick up on. And yeah, that's going to be hypertonic dehydration. So in this scenario, you'll notice that fluids will move into the capillary from your interstitial space. What happens to your cells? Shrink, yeah. They shrink up and shrivel. You ever drunk seawater?
I mean, not on purpose. But
not on purpose,
yeah. Yeah,
it's
just like I got a cup of water.
I didn't know it until
we
got the water. My son, he was drinking it.
Oh, no. Ooh, you'd think that would taste nasty and burn.
But he was just, I thought it was going to melt down. So when you're relieved, he looked like
pickled?
Yes.
I bet so.
Like his eyes was kind of sunk. And I was like, what is wrong with you? Then I was like, come on. And he was like, oh my God, something bit him.
And he'd been out there drinking the salt water.
Then I said, well, I think he's not dehydrated.
Well, that was the best thing probably to get that salt out.
I said, would you have drank the salt water? All day.
And never did it again, bet.
Well, he know now how to do it,
yeah.
Because he said he didn't feel good at all.
I bet not, because that's not good for him.
No, it's not. Oh, no.
You know, they have that game show Survivor, and there's always somebody on there that says, let's drink the ocean water, and
yeah.
Somebody says, no, no, let's drink the fresh water. You know, if you're on the game show, tell them, go drink that salt water, yeah.
Why don't you go drink that and I'm going to go drink the fresh water?
That's what you tell them, yeah. That fresh water is my idea. Yeah. So a week's time and it will kill you because it will dehydrate your cells to the point that you've got so much salt in your body that your kidneys can no longer process the blood. So the toxins build up and then, of course, that causes hallucinations and it's not the way to go. So yeah, dehydration, hypertonic dehydration is the name of this one here, number two. Fluids flow from the interstitial to the capillary and then where? Yeah, back from the cell to the interstitial, and eventually that pulls into the capillary too. Okay, let's try number three. This one says that we've got extensive diarrhea with a loss of solutes and proteins. So, yeah, that's hypotonic dehydration. And which pressure do we lose? Good, lose BOP. And the last step is to describe the fluid movement. So how do fluids move in this scenario? Good. Capillary to the interstitial fluid into the intracellular fluid. You want to try a few on your own? Let me let you do four, five, and six. Let me let you work on those by yourself or with a buddy. Four, five, and six. Okay, let's do answers for number four. We've got a loss of blood proteins for that one. Because it says just a loss of blood proteins, you're looking at which scenario? Hypotonic, good. And that's a loss of which pressure?
BOP,
good. And of course, if you lose BOP, fluids flow out into your interstitial space, and that causes edema, and eventually it goes into your cells, causing them to bloat. Good. Okay. Do okay with number four? Awesome, good. Number five, same thing, loss of protein, same exact scenario. Yeah, hypotonic dehydration, loss of BOP, and fluids flow capillary to interstitial space to the intracellular fluids. I love your t-shirt, I just now noticed it. Everybody's got to try and look at you now. Okay, number six, loss of fluids is what problem? Good. Hypertonic dehydration, we lose which pressure? Good. And fluids flow from? That's it. Interstitial to the capillary and then intracellular to the interstitial. And that eventually comes back into the capillary too. Okay. So that should take care of number six. Let's see, number seven, if you've gotten that far, loss of blood sodium is which problem? Hypotonic, good, loss of BOP, cells bloat. So the catch with number eight is we've got high blood pressure. If you have nothing else there to help you, which pressure is the same as blood pressure?
BHP.
So that's what we need to look for is excess blood pressure. What creates hydrostatic pressure?
Water.
Ah, there you go. So that one with high blood pressure is in fact high hydrostatic pressure and a gain of water. That's not a dehydration problem, is it?
No.
It's an overhydration problem, yeah. So in this one with high blood pressure, number eight, we actually have a case of hypotonic hydration. We don't have enough salt to balance the water we do have, so where do fluids flow? Yeah, interstitial fluid and then into, yeah, that's number eight.
And you say which problem? Is it, you say hypotonic?
Hydration, yeah, it's a gain of too much fluid and it pushes the fluids out. We've got high hydrostatic pressure.
Okay.
And you know, it works the same way as hypotonic dehydration because you have too few sodium ions there as well.
It says on this, the answer sheet says hypotonic dehydration.
It could be either one. If your if your perspective is one of gain, it's high hydrostatic pressure, or if your perspective is of loss, then it's low BOP. Hypertonic's a clue, yeah, because either way your cells bloat. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Well, right, you said they were essentially the same.
They're essentially the same, yeah. No matter what you name it, you're going to bloat and your cell, your fluids move out. We'll see, while we're at it, let's see number 9. We've got hypertonic IV drip loss of fluids in relation to the amount of sodium that you're losing. The loss of fluids is hypertonic. Yeah, that's a loss of BHP for number 9. And number 10, loss of blood proteins for glomerulonephritis is what problem?
Hypotonic.
Good. Lose BOP. I gave you several more problems on page 125. If you want to practice them, they're there for you. Answers at the bottom of the page. We've actually talked about the most of what's on page 126. We've done NFP at the top of the page. Oops, I took that out. Never mind. I used to have a page in there. So if you have an old course pack, you might have additional info. Let me take you back to the beginning of the chapter, and we'll do a little bit of that intro material starting on page 118. How do you feel about those practice problems? Feel pretty good? Okay, so the questions on the test may say to you that we've got a loss of fluids, what pressure is lost, or I may say to you we've got a loss of fluids, what type of dehydration is this, or I may say to you we've got a loss of fluids, what happens to your cells? So we'll just kind of pinpoint each of those three things that we were jotting down. So the backstory begins on page 118. We know that water is found in many locations in our body. What is the primary location for water to be stored? Yeah, intracellular fluid. Good. So that accounts for around 2/3 of our bodily fluids. The other 1/3 is stored in the extracellular compartment, such as interstitial fluid, blood plasma, lymph, the fluids in your eye, the fluids in your lymphatic system, the fluids in your glomeruli. So we could keep on naming all these other minor contributions to fluid storage. In total, we're looking at around 25 to 30 liters of fluid that we transport with us. So when you talk about 5 liters of blood and half of that is plasma, you realize that is actually a very small contribution to our overall fluids in our body. All right, so when we think about fluid balance, that depends on osmosis. And of course, that is what distributes fluids from one compartment to the next. Water balance also depends on your age, your gender, how much body fat you've got, and how much muscle you've got. At the bottom of your page, let me fill in those blanks for you. Water content decreases with age. Water content decreases with age. So, what's that? They joke that old people become raisins, right? So we do dry up, we prune up as we get older because we lose the fluids and those areas become transitioned to tissues. Babies have a hard time maintaining fluid balance because their body size is so tiny. Older people actually lose their thirst mechanism. It becomes less responsive. And if you have less fluids to begin with and you don't drink fluids, then you're higher at risk for getting dehydrated. Gender, let's see, we've got there, adult males have more water than females, more water. So side story here, back in the 1600s, they had the Salem witch trials, right? Mm-hmm. Witches float, witches were women, women have fat, fat floats, there's the story. If they just knew their A&P, they would have figured out why women float. So women have more body fat than men. Body fat makes you float. So So that's the bottom line there for the difference there in between men and women. Why do you think women have more fat than men? Men can be more muscular, and what is the hormone that drives the difference? Testosterone, yeah. So for women to have more muscle, you'd have to have more testosterone. So that's the driving force there. For number three, the percent body fat will decrease with an increase in body fat. So the percent water will decrease with an increase. That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? The more fat you got, the less water you got. Let's put it that way. Okay. The more fat you got, the less water you got. So percentage of water decreases with an increase in body fat. So the younger you are, if you're male, if you're muscular and lean, the more likely you are to have more water in your body. Females by nature of not having testosterone, or not a lot of it, of course, are going to make them have more fat and less water in their bodies.
So if you're overweight, can you dehydrate faster?
Probably. I'm not sure if it's an appreciable difference, but I imagine a woman that's got more body fat and less water probably would have a higher risk for it, yeah. Especially an older woman that's already less hydrated in the first place. Yeah. On the top of page 119, if you've got your highlighter handy, you know you've got your highlighters handy, right? Okay, top of the page, you'll want to highlight the total water intake and output is around 2.5 liters per day. I know you're thinking, I don't drink 2.5 liters of fluid a day. Some of you may. But it comes from your food, it comes from your digestive secretions that can be absorbed to some extent. A lot of it comes from what you drink, but we're looking at about an exchange of 2.5 liters in versus out. So most of the fluids that you get into your body come from what you eat and drink. Only about 10% comes by metabolism. And that's not enough to live off of. Since fluids primarily come in the form of what you drink, we have a thirst mechanism that makes sure that we do drink. This thirst mechanism is going to be turned on. And so what turns on your thirst mechanism? How do you know that you're thirsty? You feel dehydrated? What else?
Mouth is dry.
Mouth is dry, yeah. I don't know how much attention you pay to the quality of your saliva. But your saliva actually gets rather rubbery and thick when you're dehydrated, and that doesn't feel very good. And whether or not you consciously think that it feels nasty, you're going to feel the urge to drink. So drinking fluids helps to rehydrate your saliva, make it less rubbery like rubber cement, and helps to put the moisture back into your body. In fact, the real underlying issue is this. If you have an increased osmotic pressure, let's go back to our board. All right, if you increase your osmotic pressure, let's say that we put it up at 35 down here at the venule end, what happens to the fluids that are coming back in? Reabsorb like crazy, right? Okay, so what is the first compartment that you pull fluids from?
Interstitial.
And then you can pull them from? Intracellular. So your cells will shrivel, the fluids travel back into your capillary. Those fluids go to your kidneys, and your kidneys say, oh, hey, blood pressure looks good, let go of all this water, and then, of course, your fluids leave in your urine. That leaves behind for us rather salty blood, and the problem is salty blood is not balanced because of this exchange mechanism here. So that turns on the release of ADH. Why do we not turn on aldosterone if we're too salty? Yeah, we don't need more salt, we just need the water. So get the ADH in mode, let it go to your kidneys. DCT is going to promote water reabsorption. So yeah, don't let aldosterone run the job here. Let ADH be the one to cause water reabsorption. On your worksheet, there is a question that says, when do we stop drinking? It seems pretty obvious, and it is the obvious answer. When you're not
thirsty.
Yeah, when you're not thirsty.
So you stop drinking when you're no longer thirsting. I want to make this point because people can ignore the thirst mechanism. They don't listen to that negative feedback loop that cuts off. What is the problem if you ignore the thirst mechanism and continue to drink? Yes, good.
Hypotonic hydration. And then now you've got too many fluids and not enough salts and solutes. You got it, yeah. So that's why we need to listen to the thirst mechanism and not ignore it, because you can get to another problem in the other direction that way. Most of our fluid loss is through our kidneys. We lose around 1.5 liters of fluids per day through our kidneys. We actually lose fluids through our skin, but that is considered an insensible loss, meaning what? Do you know how much fluid you've lost through your skin today? Yeah. Me neither. That's going to be an insensible fluid loss. It's not measurable, not easily measurable, so we're not having any idea how much fluid we're losing. Fluid loss through your lungs is also insensible. I have no idea how much vapor I have breathed out today, but I do know that in the summertime I'm thirstier than the winter, right? So that hot air is, of course, driving out some of those fluids. This is a surprise. You actually lose the least amount of fluids through your feces, only around 150 or so milliliters per day, 100 to 150 through your GI tract. So, yeah, unless you got diarrhea, now you got a different problem, right? Okay, so the way we keep fluids, this is a great review for endocrine for us. Anti-diuretic hormone promotes water retention and decreases urine output. There's your blank. Decreases urine output. How is aldosterone different from ADH in its job? Salt and water, that's it. Okay, so it also decreases urine output. Decreases urine output. How do the last three influence fluid loss? Yeah, hyperventilation, fever and burns, vomiting and diarrhea all increase fluid loss in some form or fashion. All right, so since this chapter is called Fluid and Electrolyte Balance, we're now back full circle to page 120. If you've still got your highlighter handy, going down the left column of that chart, you'll notice the electrolytes are listed. Sodium is the most common cation in your interstitial fluid. Going down one more, you've got calcium is the most common cation in the body. Oh, did you catch the difference there? Five, yeah. So sodium is the most common cation in your interstitial fluids. Calcium, however, is the most common cation in your body. Calcium is majorly stored where? Bones, yeah. So that's, of course, bones and teeth is right. Potassium is mostly found inside your cells in the ICF, another thing to highlight. But you knew that before you came here, because during rest, where is sodium and where is potassium? Around a muscle or a nerve? Yeah. Sodium's outside, potassium's inside. So that just reinforces what we know. Chlorine is the most common anion in the extracellular fluids. One of the big reasons for it is we, of course, make hydrochloric acid with it. And if we had more time in this course, we could talk more about chlorine's role in the body, but it's an important one. It's just not one we get a whole lot of time with. And finally, bicarbonate is part of a buffer system that involves carbon dioxide and carbonic acid. So bicarbonate, now we've come full circle to appreciating, as part of a buffer system.
Okay, so that column is one that you'll want to know. This makes it easy. Almost everybody in that list is controlled by aldosterone except for calcium, so that should not be anything new. The function column is FYI. You probably know most of that, or at least it probably rings familiar when you read down the function column. So nothing to highlight there in the function column. And in the excess or deficiency condition, notice the bold-faced terms. Here's what you want to know. If I say that we've got a condition called hypernatremia, you say, oh, that is too many
sodium.
Yeah, too many sodiums. Or let's take another for example. Let's say we have a condition called hypocalcemia. That problem is what? Hypocalcemia is too little. Yeah, too little calcium. Or you'll want to recognize kalemia with a K as a potassium issue. And then chloremia is a chlorine issue. And then I think you guys are probably good with acid base from lab. So down at the very bottom there, you've got your acid base balance stuff full circle. Don't worry about learning the symptoms. That's just FYI in case you ever need it for another course. The main thing is to be able to use the new fancy language that hypernatremia means excess sodium. Hyponatremia means not enough sodium. So let me give you an example of how this would work. Let's say that we've got a case of hyponatremia. What type of dehydration would that lead to?
Hypotonic.
Either one. Yeah, overhydration, or it could cause hypotonic dehydration. So hyponatremia, too little sodium could go in either direction. Okay. Let's say that we've got, let's do another one there. Let's say that we've got hyperkalemia. What condition is that? High potassium, right. Do you think it's going to primarily influence what's going on with your bloodstream? Why not? It is found stored inside your cells. Yes, so that's right. That's not a big influence. But things like sodium that's outside your cells, calcium to a lesser extent there, potassium not too much since it's inside cells. Sodium's going to be our major player with this. So I don't want you to spend a lot of time memorizing that chart. Just hit those key terms, those new terms for us, and let the rest of that chart just go. We're back full circle, back to page 121. All right, so what I'd like to do is, if you want to take a break and come back and ask questions, you're welcome to. If you don't have any questions for Monday's test, then we can call it a day. We could also go ahead and cover reproductive physiology. That way, Monday after your test, you're free to go. So what is your choice? Yeah, because Monday you're going to be... Yeah. Why don't we do a break then, come back about 2:10, and if you want to cover reproductive physiology, we can knock that off our list, and we'll be done.